Good morning. The court has already been called to order. We've had some technical difficulties this morning, not from our end, so we welcome the two of you appearing. It looks like you have strong connections. Today is October 21st, 2021. We are appearing on the Zoom platform for oral argument purposes. Counsel, you're familiar with the rules of appellate procedure. 15 minutes each to state your case in chief. 5 minutes is reserved to appellate counsel for rebuttal if you choose to use that. I want to remind you to state your name and which party you are speaking on behalf of for recording purposes before you begin your argument. And with all of that said, Mr. Alger, when you're ready, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court, my name
And I am so sorry I neglected to even have the case called for hearing. Our marshal, Joe Turand, is quick to remind me. I'll ask you to call the case for presentation.
Now calling case number A210489 in re demolition of First Church of Christ Scientist.
And I indicated appellant, of course, it's the relator. So when you're ready to go ahead, thank you for that short stop on the action.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Stuart Alger, and I appear on behalf of relator MN 1400 Park Church LLC. This matter comes before the Court of Appeals on a writ of certiorari to the City of Minneapolis for review of the city's decision to deny relator a certificate of appropriateness to demolish the former First Church of Christ Scientist building in Minneapolis, which building is designated as an historic landmark but now is in a severely deteriorated state, rendering the building in an unsafe and dangerous condition.
Mr. Alger, I hate to interrupt you, but I think this is so critical to this case, and that is the standard of review. Would you address that at the outset, what you feel the standard of review here is?
Yes, Your Honor, the standard—
And why?
Yes, Your Honor. The standard of review on a writ of certiorari in this circumstance is whether the decision was arbitrary and capricious, erroneous as a matter of law, and unsupported by substantial evidence. That standard arises out of the published decisions of the Court of Appeals and the decisions of the Minnesota Supreme Court. In particular, we cited in our briefing the decision in Suline expressly sets forth that criterion those criteria rather. That was a decision that was like this one on a writ of certiorari relating to an historic preservation issue. In that case, the court said specifically that its task on review in a quasi-judicial decision is to determine whether the city council erred as a matter of law, issued a decision unsupported by substantial evidence, or acted arbitrarily and capriciously. And the decisions of this court, both published and non-precedential, apply that same standard. The Minnesota Supreme Court, I refer the court specifically to this court's decisions in Rostam-Kani, Schilling, Handicraft Block Limited Partnership. That particular case is non-precedential, but it involved an historic historic preservation issue. This court specifically cited that same standard. This is not a legislative decision in which the court would apply a more deferential standard, such as rational basis, that the city would have this court apply. This is a quasi-judicial decision, and the purpose of on review, this court will look at the specific ordinance at issue and its elements and apply that and review how the city applied that ordinance to the particular facts of this case. And in that posture, that review, the court applies a substantial evidence standard. This standard has been part of the court's jurisprudence for many years, and the Minnesota Supreme Court, looking back as far as the Beck v. City of St. Paul decision in 1951, the Minnesota Supreme Court applied a substantial basis standard of review. The decisions in Dietz out of the Minnesota Supreme Court and Hahn all support that same standard. There's no court, there's no decision of the Minnesota Supreme Court that would create a sweeping change of what has been the longstanding standard of review on a writ of certiorari, particularly in a circumstance like this, where the court is reviewing an historic preservation, in this case, a certificate of appropriateness decision.
How do you distinguish this from the Mendota Golf versus City of Mendota Heights case, which was
that case, Your Honor, related to a zoning issue where the court applied a more deferential standard and essentially a legislative standard, which is the standard that would be applied in a legislative zoning or rezoning decision. This is not that kind of decision. This is a quasi-judicial decision under review.
But is this more related to zoning as opposed to something else?
There's one case that the city cites in its argument that this is a zoning issue and so a zoning standard should be applied, and that is the 500 LLC decision. That decision related to a specific issue about whether the 60-day rule under MnSTAT 15.99 applied. And the court in that decision said, yes, for the purposes of that statute and whether we applied in this circumstance, we'll deem this decision a zoning decision. But there's no statement in that decision that this would be a new standard of review that would apply to that would essentially overrule and do away with the standard that was enunciated in Suline and that had been applied for many years in the quasi-judicial decision. So no, for the purposes of determining whether the standard of review is appropriate here, this is not a zoning decision. It's a decision about whether the city correctly applied the elements of its ordinance to this certificate of appropriateness decision and whether its decision relied on substantial evidence.
And I have one more question and then I'm going to shut up and let you finish. In Suline, one of the remedies that was talked about was a remand for additional findings. Would that be appropriate in this case if we've decided in your favor?
In this case, Your Honor, that is one option. However, I think in this instance, the court can make a determination that the decision of the city was not supported by substantial evidence and arbitrary and capricious. And overturn the decision in order that the city grant the certificate of appropriateness.
Okay. Thank you.
The one of the principal disputes joined here, and it's before the court, is the particular the particular application of what's in the ordinance under 599.350B2. And just to quickly frame the discussion, the criteria that the city applies is set out in determining whether to grant a certificate of appropriateness is set out in 599.350. And 350 is divided into A and B factors. And there's discussion in our briefing about the proper application of the A factors, which I can get into. But one key issue here is whether there was substantial evidence for the city to conclude that the application did not meet the standard for demolition under B2. B, 599.350B applies when the application for a certificate of appropriateness relates to demolition in whole or in part, or destruction in whole or in part. And this application is for a complete demolition of the property. So B applies. And under B, there are two criteria that the city can look at. One, and this creates in effect, a balancing test for the city, or a balancing review balancing factors. Under B, 599.350B, destruction in whole would be appropriate if either the building is unsafe and demolition is necessary to correct an unsafe condition, or if there is no reasonable financial possibility to rehabilitate and reuse the building. And it's that B2 factor or analysis that's joined in particularly here, as the city is relying heavily on its determination that it made a reasoned decision in concluding that there is a reasonable and feasible financial alternative to destruction of this building.
Well, the record does show that a city official conceded or stated that the building was in danger of collapse, that it was not in good repair. But what I understand the city's argument to be is, at what point do we allow owners to just sit back and do nothing? And I think somebody in at the hearing called it demolition by neglect, but where you just sit back and allow it to just continue to get worse and worse and worse and worse. It makes the entire proceedings pretty pointless, because if you wanted to have that happen, that's all you would do. How do you respond to that? What's your greatest point in support of your client's claim that he did not engage in that tactic?
Well, two responses, Your Honor. First off, that criterion, demolition by neglect, and as you point out, it's manifest throughout the record and the arguments by the city, is not a criterion that's set out in 599.350. There's nothing that directs the city to consider what it deems, demolition by neglect, as a factor it should consider. So to the extent it relies on that factor, and it seems that it does, that is an exercise of the city's will and not its judgment. But secondly, and sort of getting to, in that score, it's not appropriate to consider that factor. But in addition to that, Your Honor, there is evidence in the record of the owner's efforts after it purchased the building in 2015 to shore up the building. It immediately undertook a study of what would be necessary to prevent the collapse of the building. Snow loads were a particular concern, and it did that. And then it actually, by what I mean, Your Honor, is that it did undertake that that shoring work, received what was called a certificate of no change from the city, and did that work to shore up the building. So to say that this particular owner isn't worthy of a certificate of appropriateness because it proceeded by demolition by neglect is simply contrary to the facts in the record. And there's evidence that its predecessors also did work. There was a roof replacement evidenced in the record in 2004. And the city has other remedies, Your Honor. I mean, if the city believes that this building that is in a condition and has it of such where there needs to be an abatement and there needs to be a shoring up, then it can proceed under its other the other remedies available to it to make those orders on the owner. The building has been unoccupied since 2006. It's on the city's list of vacant properties. And you know, while we don't get into the briefing, and just in response to your question, the city could pursue and require that the owner take steps to do what it needs to do under that process, which there's no evidence that the city here did.
What about the rehabilitation plan in 2019? Doesn't that show a reasonable alternative to demolition?
Your Honor, no, it doesn't. The 2019 plan, which was required by the city in order to get the certificate of no change to shore up the building, was a plan that showed how the city might be mothballed for 10 years, which is for the standard under National Historic Preservation Regulations, but it didn't contain a cost associated with it. And it's really not clear that if that work was done, that it would have responded to the issues that were pointed out by the city's own inspector in 2019, that this building is in danger of imminent collapse. For example, I believe that the plan—
Mr. Alter, your time has expired, if you could wrap up.
Yes. The city has not met its requirements, what it's required to do. Certainly its decision is arbitrary and capricious. It's not supported by substantial evidence. And Relator asks this court to order that the certificate of appropriateness be issued to the relator. Thank you.
We'll hear from Respondent City.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Brian Carter. I'm representing the respondent, City of Minneapolis, in this matter. I'll just jump right in with the standard of review. I do think that this is a very important issue, not necessarily for this case, because I think under the substantial evidence standard or any other standard, those are met here, given the record. But the standard of review of a quasi-judicial matter coming out of the city of Minneapolis is a very important issue to the city that comes up in other cases. And I first want to start by, frankly apologizing, because after I read the Relator's reply brief, look back at my brief, I don't think I did a very good job working through that standard of review and analysis. So I went back to square one, and I took another look at it. And the first thing I want to say specifically, the issue that Relator points out in their brief of the quasi-legislative cases. And I think they're right that there is a difference in reviewing a quasi-judicial case versus a quasi-legislative case. And here we have, I think, pretty clearly a quasi-judicial determination that's focused on one particular set of facts and is dominated by that particular circumstances. It's not a sort of bigger legislative action. Having said that, I think the other piece of the puzzle here is that Minnesota courts apply two different standards when reviewing quasi-judicial determinations. Two different broad standards of review. One standard applies to quasi-judicial determinations that are made under the Minnesota Administrative Procedures Act. The other is applied to quasi-judicial standards that are not made under the Administrative Procedures Act. The city of Minneapolis is never under the Minnesota Administrative Procedures Act because that act only applies to agencies with statewide jurisdictions. And that's found in the definition of agency in the APA. And moreover, in the Dietz case, which is 487 Northwest 2nd, 237, also makes the point that if an agency doesn't have statewide jurisdiction, you don't follow the APA. Okay, so we're not under the APA. So what is the other standard? If the court were to look at Anderson versus Commissioner of Health, and that's at 811 Northwest 2D162, at page 165, there is the quote, on certiorari appeal from a quasi-judicial agency decision not subject to the Administrative Procedures Act, we examine the record to review questions affecting the jurisdiction of the agency, the regularity of its proceedings, and as to the merits of the controversy, whether the order or determination in the particular case was arbitrary, oppressive, unreasonable, under an erroneous theory of law, and this is the important point when it comes to evidence, or, quote, without any evidence to support it. So that's the correct standard when we're not under the APA.
So let me just interrupt real quick, Mr. Carter, because this whole argument is sounding new to me. Did you make this argument in your briefing at all? And if not, why isn't it waived at this point?
I did not clearly articulate this basis for getting to the standard of review we have in our brief, which is more deferential, I think, than the substantial evidence standard of review. So I think you're right that I didn't cite the Anderson case. I do hope this is helpful to the court. I think it is important that the court get the correct standard of review, regardless of whether the parties have correctly stated it in the briefing. So I guess I would frame it that way. And again, I apologize for not having the citation in the brief. But I do think you get to the same points, the same standard of review that we get to in the brief. This is just, I think, the more formal, correct way of getting at that standard of review. And so if you look at the APA, if you have a quasi-judicial determination under the APA, that's where the substantial evidence review comes in. We aren't under the APA, and that's why the city is correct in its brief that the substantial evidence standard does not apply. And I would commend the courts to take a look at the Minnesota Practice Series, Administrative Practices and Procedures Volume, Section 14.06.2, which is a good treatment of this fairly complicated issue that, quite frankly, some of the case law is not clearly stating the correct standards. So that's the standard of review, and it's not substantial evidence, as we argued in our brief. And we also point to the Big Lakes Association case in our brief as well. And that, I think, gives important gloss on the correct standard of review. That's 761 Northwest 2nd, 487. And in that Supreme Court case, the court talks about reviewing a non-APA quasi-judicial standard determination. And it says that it is a very limited and deferential review of a quasi-judicial decision. And this is rooted in separation of powers issues. That those determinations, quote, have wide latitude in making decisions. And except in rare cases where there is no rational basis for the decision, it is the duty of the judiciary to exercise restraints and accord appropriate deference to the civil authorities. And this is a zoning case, but you know, as we make the points in our brief, you know, there's no substantive difference between a land use decision under a Heritage Preservation Act versus a land use decision under a zoning act. It is the same type of fundamental land use decision with the same procedures in place. And we think that that gloss that the courts have put on reviewing quasi-judicial determinations of whether to grant a variance or a CUP or what have you, all of that case law applies in these heritage preservation cases as well. I do also want to make one final point about the standard of review, and that's an important point for the APA, because the APA, there are basically two evidentiary standards of review under the APA. There's one that applies when you have a contested hearing, and that's the substantial evidence test. When there is a less formal quasi-judicial determination, it is the arbitrary and capricious standard. And again, I point the court to the Minnesota Practice Series for an explanation of that. The final point is this to make on the standard of review is that the substantial evidence standard is, I recall, you know, a decade ago, my admin professor saying, you know, substantial evidence is not a lot of evidence. And I think that's an important point to make. If you look at the definition of substantial evidence, it's more than a scintilla, more than some, more than any, and this is the one that I find most useful, enough to deny a directed verdict. So that it doesn't take much evidence to get to denial of a directed verdict. And I do want to contrast that with the standard of any evidence from the Anderson case for non-APA quasi-judicial determinations, because I do think that under non-APA cases that any evidence standard is even a notch lower than the substantial evidence standard. And I think that's kind of a more formal way of putting it than we did in our brief. Okay. And I think in this particular case, under any standard, the substantial evidence standard or the any evidence standard, I think that the record supports the city's decision in this case. And I'll talk about that next.
Let me just address one question, if I may, about on September 27th of 2019, there was a letter from the city of Minneapolis to the appellants, the Kenneth Stalock letter, that said that the property was in an unsafe condition and that generally it was dangerous to the public. How does this, how do you square that with the fact that it shouldn't be demolished?
Well, I think that is one piece of evidence that says that in its current state, it is dangerous. I think the question is whether that current condition makes under factor B1, whether that makes destruction necessary. And I think the clear response to that is if you look at the record, there's a rehabilitation plan. A recent rehabilitation plan that demonstrates that rehabilitation is not possible. So the test isn't the current condition of the property. The test is whether you have to tear it down or not to correct the unsafe condition if it's that far gone. And I think that the realtor's own rehabilitation plan demonstrates that no, you can rehabilitate it. So the next question then is, does that cost so much that it's not a reasonable alternative? Because maybe it doesn't pro forma out on the use of the property. And this is, I think, the point that I think this case turns on. And the first thing I want to talk about is the burden here, because under how the ordinance is written, it is the realtor's burden to prove that negative. The realtor has to prove that there are no reasonable alternatives. So I think it would be error to then look at the examine the evidence of the record and swap the burdens and say, okay, the city now has the burden of showing that there are reasonable alternatives. No, that's not the way it works. And if you think about it,
what are the reasonable alternatives? I mean, the city's position on both factors of subparagraph B seems pretty conclusory. On the dangerousness, it says, well, it hasn't fell in the last year, so it must not be that dangerous. And on the other factor, it says, well, there's other alternatives without highlighting them. What are we to look at to say there are reasonable alternatives? Relator has said, you know, we're looking at $4 million to rehabilitate this. And, you know, the highest use of the property is for office space, and any lesser use is still going to be prohibitive. So, I mean, what are we to look at in the record to show, other than a conclusory statement, that there's a reasonable alternative?
Exactly where I was going. So the first question, is it necessary to demolish the building? Again, even the realtor's own plan shows that it is not necessary. It can be rehabilitated. It does not need to come down. The second point is reasonable alternatives. It is realtor's burden to prove that there are no reasonable alternatives. So just like at the close of the plaintiff's or the state's case, the court can take a look at the evidence and determine if the person with the burden of evidence met that burden. And here, I think it is reasonable to conclude that no, the realtor did not. And that's because they looked at only one alternative use, and that was office space. So they only did one alternative use. The second point is, I think throughout the record, it's clear that the city looked at the realtor's credibility skeptically. And part of that is the demolition by neglect argument. And so that is an important point, is just the fact that the city is able to look at the evidence and determine if it's sufficient to meet the burden. And here, I don't think it is. But the other point is, there is other evidence in the record that goes against what the realtor is saying. And specifically, that evidence in the record is from staff expert testimony. And staff expert testimony is good evidence that the agency can rely on. And you see that in the Billy Graham case. We cite that in our brief. There are other cases where staff expert testimony is accepted as good evidence an agency can rely on. The St. Croix development case, 46 Northwest 2D 397, NRA request of North Metro Harness, that's unpublished 2013 WL 4711204 at 4. All of those cases look at staff testimony and they treat it on par with expert testimony. And here city staff said—
I need to remind you, your time has expired too, but finish your thought and wrap up, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm sorry for going over time. And here staff experts said, no, they have not exhausted other reasonable alternatives. They have only looked at office use. They have not looked at other uses that might cost less to rehabilitate and bring that number down and change that cost benefit analysis. And so that evidence is in the record. That meets the any evidence record in combination with the questions of plaintiff's credibility and their burden. And it also, I think, meets the substantial evidence test as well, which is a low burden. And thank you, Your Honor, for allowing me to finish that thought.
Thank you, and we'll go back to you, Mr. Alger.
Thank you, Your Honor. As the city's argument demonstrates, the only evidence that they can point to that is countervailing, that would negate the evidence in the record, the substantial evidence in the record provided by Relator, that there is no feasible or reasonable alternative to demolition of this building, Our conclusory statements by city staff and expressions of judgment and opinion. And that is simply not enough under any standard, even if you're looking at just the deferential standard that the city wants to apply to support a denial under criterion B2. The decisions of this court, as we cite in our brief, stand for that proposition. If you look particularly, this is actually a Minnesota Supreme Court case, the Minnesota Power and Light Company case from 1983. In that decision, the court said, where the experts from the deciding authority are exercising their judgment, they have to base their judgment on something. It can't just simply be a determination that that we think we're right and the applicant is wrong. There has to be some basis for the decision. Really, I mean, otherwise it would be next to impossible for an applicant to meet this requirement, because all the deciding authority would have to say is simply, well, we don't agree. We think you're wrong. And if that's enough to overcome the wealth of evidence that the applicant provides, then there's really nothing the applicant can do. In this case, the only evidence on this issue is the evidence proffered by the applicants, and it's in the record. There's four different economic analyses: one in 2016, one in 2019. A review in 2020 and another, a review in 2019 and then another analysis in 2020. All of those analyses point to the fact that the cost to rehabilitate this building far exceeds the amount of money this building would need to cash flow to make this, make development, a redevelopment or rehabilitation feasible here. The city's staff says, well, there may be another use that's less costly, but there's no evidence to support that. And of course, in the record, the applicant disputes that, pointing out that no matter what use you make of this building in its deteriorated state, which is undisputed here, would require significant investment to make the building work, even if it was residential or some other sort of use other than the office use. But the applicant looked at office use, which was the highest and best use, could generate the most rents in the market. And even under that scenario, corroborated by an independent review, this rehabilitation of this building would not be economically feasible. That's the only evidence that was before the city. And the city just simply dismissed it, set it aside, saying, well, we think there might be another use, or that there might be some way to tweak the costs that would make this less costly. There's no evidence that's possible. Or the city says, well, if you reduce the costs, maybe the historic tax credits would be more viable for later. There's no evidence of that's possible either. In fact, the review in the record said that, when you're getting the tax credits over $1 million, it's getting very iffy whether any kind of redevelopment project like this would work. That's the evidence before the city. There's no countervailing substantial evidence on the other side. With respect to the additional arguments now that are being put forward by the city with respect to the APA, those arguments haven't been made in the briefing. But nonetheless, you can look at the decisions that have been cited by Relator here and see that that the substantial evidence applies in this context, specifically held by this court. And of course, there are other decisions too that aren't cited in our briefing that support that same proposition. But the Soo Line case is the most direct expression of that. And even the Minnesota Supreme Court applies substantial basis, substantial evidence. And I also want to point out that, I'm out of time, Your Honor. I don't want to, may I just finish this thought?
Please finish that thought. And for whatever reason, I don't even see the clock on our screen anymore, but thank you for being mindful of that. I knew it was in the countdown. There it is.
Simply to say that, the 2019 plan was not a rehabilitation plan. It was intended to be a stabilization plan. There's no cost associated with it. It was required by the city in order to get a certificate of no change, which the relator undertook to shore up the building. But to say that that plan would work to prevent the building from collapse is beyond the record. The city's own inspector said the building is in danger of imminent collapse. There's no evidence that the plan in 2019 would have provided the kind of exterior support that the engineer or the city's own building official said was needed.
Thank you to both attorneys. The matters were very well briefed and the argument helps us in connection with our deliberations. The matters are submitted and a decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe.